I'm Matthew Petty, and this is Intersection.
Chasing the Moon is a six-hour documentary series about the space race from its earliest beginnings to the monumental achievement of the first lunar landing in 1969 and beyond. The series debuts on PBS in July ahead of the 50th anniversary of Apollo 11. Well, joining me now from WGBH in Boston is Robert Stone. He's the director of Chasing the Moon. Robert, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me. It's great to be here.
This is quite an ambitious task, right? A six-hour series. What would you say was the kind of spark that set it all off? Like, what was your impression of the space race as a kid and growing up?
Well, I was 10 years old when they landed on the moon, and which is a very impressionable age. I'd also just gone to see the Stanley Kubrick's 2001 about 6 months before that, which is the film that really inspired me to start thinking about being a filmmaker, actually. So all this stuff was going on, and we, you know, Apollo 8 had just gone around the moon for the first time, and it was a life-changing experience that I'll never forget. And I felt in the all the years since, there's been a lot of books, a lot of movies done about this, but I saw an opening to do something different, and then I felt I wanted to make a film that really captured what I remember it feeling like as a little kid growing up, watching these rockets go up into space in anticipation that this great event of life, humanity leaving the planet for the first time and going off to another world, what that was like for us here on Earth, and what the experience of watching two members of the human race walk around on another planet and watching that in a little black and white grainy image, and how we all, everybody around the world, felt this momentary sense of unity and common humanity. And that was what I wanted to capture. I wanted to capture the astronaut experience as well, but that's a story that has been told before. So I wanted to do something different. I saw an opportunity to do that. And so that was really the kernel of me thinking, you know, that I can contribute something new and original and fresh. So the fact that this was a globalized television event that we all watched simultaneously live was what made it a communal experience. And I think that was the main event, and that's the heart of the story. As much as the astronaut experience going to the moon is an interesting one, I think what's truly unique about that moment was the first time we did this in the sense of accomplishment and a sense of us all being a part of something bigger than ourselves, a sense that these were emissaries of the human race and not just two Americans walking on the moon.
So, Robert, this will be a nostalgia trip for folks like yourself who remember seeing that, watching those first steps on the moon. And it, also, I get the sense you're trying to recreate what it was like for people who weren't there.
Absolutely. I mean, that's I think, something that I really wanted to communicate to young people who missed it, to experience what it was like and to put the whole story of the race to the moon within its historical context, because you can't really understand it or glean any meaning from it or get anything more from it other than, well, this thing that happened long ago, unless you see it in the context of why did we do this and what did it mean to us at the time. And I think there's a lot of lessons for younger people today, I think, who are as hungry as we were back then to be a part of something bigger than themselves and to take pride in a sense of national accomplishment that we had then. And I think there's a lot of lessons to be derived from that come out of seeing how this whole project came together and the political and social and cultural context that it happened in.
So much of the film comprises archival footage. What was the process like to find that footage and then restore it?
Well, there's a ton of archival footage that has not been seen before. We went way beyond just the NASA collection, which is, you know, incredibly voluminous in and of itself. I mean, every time they tighten the bolt, they seem to have pulled out a 16-millimeter camera and filmed it. So there's an incredible amount of material in the NASA collection. But we went way beyond that. I think we went into nearly 100 different archives to source footage that's actually, you know, in the series. And with a lot of contemporaneous news accounts, there's no talking heads. So it's a fully immersive experience where history is unfolding as it happened without the sense of it being inevitable. Anything could have happened. along the way. It could have failed. It could have gone this way. It could have gone that way. We also delve into what the Russians were doing at the time. So the aim of the film is to give an audience a sense of what it was like to be alive at this time when this incredibly ambitious undertaking was presented and worked on and developed. And there was an uncertainty about whether it was ever going to be successful or achieved at all, and to really play that out without the sense of inevitability.
So the film doesn't begin with the story of Apollo 11, with Kennedy's now famous moon speech, but instead in 1957. Why did you choose to tell the story starting more than a decade before the moon landing?
Well, Sputnik happened in October 1957. This was the first satellite, the first human object to ever go into space, which launched by the Soviet Union, our arch enemy at the time. And America was completely shocked. We thought that we were the preeminent technological superpower. And here was this second-rate country that we thought of as and they'd outdone us and done this spectacular feat of putting a satellite into orbit. And that really kicked off a whole series of events that ultimately led to President Kennedy proposing that we put a man on the moon. The Russians put the first satellite into space. A month later, they put a dog into space, which hinted at the possibility of them sending humans into space. The first American attempt to put a satellite in orbit spectacularly blew up on the launch pad, and there's a real sense that America had fallen behind. And Kennedy, in his first year in office, was having a pretty tough time, and within 4 months of taking office, the Soviets launched the first man into orbit, Yuri Gagarin. And Kennedy was desperate to do something. He campaigned on a sense of turning a corner and revitalizing America's worldwide prestige, and here we were getting our getting kicked in the butt by the Russians and humiliated. So he cast about, like, what can we do? What can we do to beat the Soviet Union in this field of space? And they came to the conclusion there's no way they could beat the Russians at the moment, because the Russians had bigger rockets. They were way ahead of us in the current space technology. But if we move the goalpost and we did a completely different race to the moon, that it would require both the Russians and the Americans to develop entirely new series of rockets and new techniques that had never been tried, and nobody actually knew how to get to the moon in either the Soviet Union or the United States, that would reset the clock, and we were both countries would be starting at zero. And America did have a technological edge, and it also had the world's greatest rocket engineer, Wernher von Braun. And there was a sense that we had the advantage and could probably win that. And so Kennedy suggested, he challenged the Soviet Union to go to the moon, and off we were. Interestingly enough, and we reveal this in the film, one of the people I interviewed for the film is Nikita Khrushchev's son. Nikita Khrushchev was the premier of the Soviet Union. His son was by his father's side throughout all of this and was himself a leading Soviet rocket engineer. And he tells us that the Russians at that time didn't really have any plans to go to the moon. They were just doing space spectaculars with no really thought out plan. So in the early days there, we were really racing against ourselves.
The moon shot or the moon ambitions kind of caught the Soviet Union on the hop a bit, it sounds like. We're talking to Robert Stone. He's the director of the documentary series Chasing the Moon, which debuts on PBS in July. So, Robert, the film also explores how political factors and public perception drove the mission. When did you realize that this was just as important as the scientific and engineering advances that went into the mission?
Oh, very early on when I first began this project, that was, I think, one of the most intriguing things to me. And I thought was a story that really hadn't been told. Is that as difficult as it was a technological feat, just to get two human beings safely to the moon, get out, walk about, get back home safely, as difficult as that was, and nobody knew how to do it at the time, an equally difficult prospect was sustaining public and political support over the better part of a decade through multiple administrations. To keep this project going, which was, at its high point, was employing 2% of the American workforce and costing an extraordinary amount of money. It was $24 billion in 1960s dollars, which is approximately about $250 billion today. It was an enormous undertaking. And again, I think that story of how that came about has not been told.
NASA is eyeing another moonshot. They want to attempt to land humans at the south pole of the moon. Are you seeing some of the same political and public motivation happening now that there was 50, 60 years ago?
I'm not, and I think this is another important lesson that the film, you know, has for our current generation and our fascination with going into space. Is I think there's a real hunger to recapture the magic of Apollo 11 and the magic of the Apollo project itself, of leaving the Earth for the first time and doing something that nobody had done before, developing new technologies, developing new techniques in space that had never been invented or even thought of before, and how that, you know, all of that work really jump-started and ignited the technological revolution that has altered our lives down to, you know, our iPhones and the miniaturization of everything. So going back to the moon now is not gonna require any new technological innovation that isn't already, you know, off the shelf really, and it's not doing anything that we haven't done before. And I also don't see any follow through in terms of generating public support or congressional support or even getting really serious budgetary support to do this. I mean, every president going back for the last 30 years has made some pronouncement about going back to the moon or going to Mars or going somewhere, trying to do their version of the Rice University speech. But there's never been the follow-through. And I think one of the really unique things about Apollo is it's a case study in how to do something audacious and massive and transformative. And it's a lot more than just getting on a soapbox and giving a speech. It really requires a lot of political savvy and marketing and PR and getting the public behind it and just pushing and pushing and pushing every day to get this over the hill and to succeed. So I think there's a desire to recapture the magic of Apollo, but I don't think we necessarily need to do the same thing to do that. I think it'd be great to do something bold and audacious that would bring this country together, but it doesn't necessarily have to be a repeat of going back and doing something we did before.
What about the idea of some of the things that the commercial space companies are doing? I mean, for example, SpaceX launching rockets into orbit and then landing the boosters on remote-controlled ships at sea. I mean, that does seem to capture some of that spirit of awe from the public that, you know, maybe not to the same scale as the moon missions, but there is still some pretty amazing kind of technological prowess going on there, and it does seem to be capturing the public's imagination to a degree.
Oh, absolutely. But these are private companies that are not requiring, you know, congressional support and massive political and public relations campaign to sustain financially. I think what SpaceX is doing is amazing in that they're making space affordable. I mean, what we were doing with Apollo was the equivalent of like building a 747 and flying it once across the Atlantic. You know, even that doesn't really capture the craziness of how we were going into space back then. It was too costly to keep doing. So I think what Elon Musk is doing, what Blue Origin, Jeff Bezos' team is doing, and also the one that the late Paul Allen has developed, and Richard Branson's project, I think these are incredibly innovative things that are going to make space travel affordable. But it's not the sort of government-run national program of the sort of scale that Apollo was.
So if not the moon, is there something space-related that could inspire the public and have some effect of motivating the entire country, or at least the political powers that be in Washington, to drive forward in a single direction?
I think going to Mars might be an interesting next step. It's something that has never been done before. It's as boldly ambitious as going to the moon. It's going to require technologies and techniques that do not exist at this point. It's way, way more complicated than going to the moon, way more audacious. So I think that could be an inspiring thing. But there's also other things that we could do that would bring us together, that would give us a sense of national accomplishment and national purpose. I mean, solving climate change might be an equally bold national objective as well. There's other things we can do that would capture that same spirit encourage technological innovation and bring us together.
We've been speaking with Robert Stone. He's the director of the three-part, six-hour documentary Chasing the Moon. It debuts on PBS in July. Robert, thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you. It's a pleasure.
Still to come on Intersection, after graduation from college comes the challenge of finding a job. But what kind of challenges face graduates with learning disabilities? We'll have that conversation when Intersection returns. This is Intersection. I'm Matthew Petty. Beacon College just graduated its largest class ever, 85 students. Beacon College was founded in 1989 to educate students with learning disabilities. So what opportunities in the workforce are there for graduates with learning disabilities? From the Education Desk this week, a conversation about the opportunities and challenges facing those students. Esteban Lopez is Director of Corporate and Academic Outreach at Beacon College. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
And Jeremy Nielsen is a Career Development Instructor at Beacon College. Thanks, Jeremy.
Thank you for having me.
So, Esteban, Beacon is the first accredited baccalaureate school dedicated to students with learning disabilities. Tell me a little bit about the population that you serve and the demand for the courses that you teach.
Yes, we were born about 30 years ago, but a group of parents back in that day, they thought that they couldn't find the type of accommodations for their students. The school was founded to serve students with dyslexia back in that day, but now we serve all types of learning disabilities. Nowadays, we have a little over 400 students here in Central Florida, mm-hmm. With all sorts of disabilities, you name it, ADHD, under the spectrum, autism disorder, anxiety, and many others.
And so, Esteban, how many students do you have at the college?
Currently, we have about 405 students. I think we are planning to open this academic semester in fall with about 435 students. Mm-hmm. We're growing in that sense. We are serving this important population, which is severely underserved right now.
And where does your student body come from? Is it from all over the state? Are they from out of state as well?
Yes, we have students from almost 40 different states and from 9 different countries. About 35% of our students are from here, from Florida.
Mm-hmm. Jeremy, tell me a little bit about the courses that you teach.
The courses that I teach, there's essentially 4 courses that the students take throughout their career at Beacon in career development. And I teach 3 out of the 4. So we basically, our first course that we teach is College Essentials. It deals with social, emotional, to help them deal with, you know, different social aspects that they'll have at college. And then I take over from there with a course in exploration. So it's working with them to understand who they are, what their strengths are, what their weaknesses are, where they are going to be a best fit for when they head home. And so we do a lot of assessments. We try to understand who they are. And then our final junior and senior courses, we work with them on basically marketing themselves through cover letters, resumes, LinkedIn profiles, and we do a lot of mock interviews. Mm-hmm. So we basically take the job interview process and make it as authentic as possible. So they start analyzing the job description, how to look at the job description, how to determine what is a good fit for them, and basically how to apply for that specific job description. So everything's tailored, and we try to make everything as authentic as possible.
Going to college for the first time is challenging anyway, right? So if you have a learning disability on top of that, what are the things you have to be aware of and think about when designing a course for this particular kind of student?
Yeah, that's a really good question, because it's something that we get trained on, it seems like just about every week, or we're constantly reading up on, is basically how to teach people with learning disabilities. And so often, I guess, in a class where someone would attend with a learning disability, there's going to be a handout, something they can touch with their hands. It might be in a color other than white paper. It's going to be in a classroom with touch screens where they can expand and touch the screen, the computer. They can have the text read to them. All my quizzes are you can listen to the mm-hmm. and touch the screen in order to answer questions. But it's very authentic instruction. It's project based. So a lot of my projects are this is what we need to develop by the end of the course, or this is what we need to create by the end of class. And so we do a lot of higher level learning, I guess, with evaluation, like evaluating other students and their resumes. We do a lot of coaching one-on-one with students. Mm-hmm. Anything that I don't have time for, there's learning specialists for each one of the students at Beacon College that they can go to and work one-on-one with the instruction and the lessons that I have. I basically can hand them off to those supports.
And how big is your class?
They don't get any bigger than 18 students. Mm-hmm. But sometimes they can be as small as, I'd say, 5. You could have 5 students in one class, mm-hmm. which is great because you get to, you know, you constantly get this. You want to be with them one-on-one and coach with them one-on-one as much as possible.
Esteban, Jeremy was talking about the final course he teaches, which is basically giving the students the skills they need to succeed in job interviews and kind of make that step out into the wide world after graduating. What kind of stats do you have from Beacon as far as placing students or making sure they have the best start possible and are in jobs after they leave college?
Well, I think that's a very important question. There's two fundamental statistics that are here. The first one is how many students with a learning disability complete a bachelor's degree. Mm-hmm. That's really, really important. And once you have a college degree, a college credential, you are more employable. Beacon, we have a significant success in this area. We have about 70% of our students graduate within 4 years, which is an amazing number. The national average is about only 30%, and that's for traditional students, not only for students with learning disabilities.
So you're doing better than students in regular college.
Oh, yeah, for sure. We developed this unique model over the last 30 years, and we are really, really good at it.
But is it partly because you have, as Jeremy was saying, smaller class sizes? There's kind of more individualized attention per student?
Most definitely. And it's not only in the classroom. It's the entire school is designed for these students from dorms. For instance, when you are a freshman, you will be placed in a single room. Mm-hmm. rather than in a double or a triple because your social skills are not there. If you are under the spectrum, you might not be mature enough or develop your social skills to a point to have a roommate. So mm-hmm. by your senior year, we'll be in a double with a different student. So it's kind of a reverse to what happened in other colleges. So in other colleges, you'll be in a double or a triple as a freshman. As mm-hmm. when you are a senior, you might have your own room. Here's the other way around. The employability question, about 85% of our students, they find a job within 1 year of graduation in our school. Yeah. So that's a significant number.
What about opportunities, though? Are they leaving Central Florida? Are they able to find jobs in this area?
Yeah, and actually we have a lot of, as I mentioned before, we have students from nearly 40 states, and actually they come to Florida, they like it here, and they mm-hmm. want to pursue careers here. So we are attracting a lot of talent here to Central Florida, which is a good thing. We have a hospitality major, for instance, and we place these students in some of the largest hotels in the world. We have a partnership with Wyndham that we just took 11 students to a site tour a few months ago there, to a 1,400-room facility. So you name it. We place our students all over the place. But not only here in Florida, but also in other states like in Texas or in Virginia, in other states as well.
And you have pretty good connections with businesses that offer opportunities to people who may have learning disabilities?
Oh, yes. Yes. And actually, one of the things that we do in our school is to go out there, outreach these companies, explain exactly what are the type of accommodations that they need to provide mm-hmm. to our students, if any, and also the benefits of having our students. Just to name a few, for instance, the military industry is an industry of about $800 billion. We have Lockheed Martin and some other companies right here in Central Florida. And
yeah, it's a big deal in Orlando.
Yeah, they provide thousands of jobs. And if you are a military contractor, you are required by a law to have about 7% of your employees with a disability. So mm-hmm. they reach out to us because we have one of the few students with a learning disability with a bachelor's degree. Mm-hmm. I was checking yesterday some statistics on the about this, and about only 4% of individuals with a disability, they end up having a bachelor's degree. So that's only 4%. And if you're required to have a 7% of your employees with a disability, so you really have to find them. And we are one place to do so.
You're listening to Intersection on 90.7 News. I'm Matthew Petty. We're talking to Esteban Lopez and Jeremy Nielsen from Beacon College, talking about the opportunities and challenges facing students with learning disabilities. Jeremy, something that Esteban mentioned kind of caught my ear there. I guess you have to be mindful of the kind of sensory environment that some of the students may be placed in. I'm sure some of them, maybe it's their first time away from home. What kind of challenges are there? And from your experience, how is Beacon College different in design from any other college?
Well, I think that something that I've really noticed over this last year that's been a focus on is the social emotional intelligence. And we do instruction in each class that I have. I teach it for about 2 weeks for each course. And it basically helps them become more aware of their own emotions and helping them understand that they need to be more aware of what's going on inside of them. Because a lot of students, I think, go to a traditional college and they don't realize the challenges that they're going through, that there is actual training for that. So one area that we work on is just helping them understand what they're feeling, but also in order for them to work and be productive with the people that are around them, they have to start to read and understand body language and people that are communicating with them that they may have not been aware of up until that point that they got to college. So we provide a lot of social experiences for them so that they can get out into the world and start observing it and start recognizing themselves in this world. And a lot of it, I know because I worked in a high school at Dr. Phillips High School here in OCPS County, and a lot of times these students get passed by while they're in high school.
And that's a big school too.
Yeah, and it's a difficult challenge because the classrooms in the public school system are filled with people. The teachers only have so much amount of time. I believe that one period was 48 minutes a day, and then they were out and they were gone to their next class. With Beacon, you get to kind of crack open that shell when you get them. And I know that I've talked to the president about this. In fact, when I was interviewed, he interviews everybody that goes to the college. And when I was interviewed by him, I remember him telling me, he said, I've been to a lot of graduations and I've been doing this for a long time. But he's like, when you go to one of our graduations, he's like, there's not a dry eye. Because he says you get to see them transform throughout the time that they spend with Beacon. And by the time that they leave Beacon, they're just this, they have their heads up. You know, and they communicate with people and they share the joy, I guess, that they, you know, they have an outlook on life and a vision.
So what have you learned in your time at Beacon? Because it sounds like, you know, that there's, you're helping sort of train and sort of mold these young minds, but there is also some training that needs to go on for people out in the world about how to interact with people who might have a learning disability, may not have had the same opportunities as them growing up or going to college, right?
Yeah. It's working at Beacon's, I consider it to be a privilege. And I've never looked at like any kind of sacrifice that's at Beacon it's just never a sacrifice. You know, there's a distance I have to drive, but I've never complained about it. And it is a service to work with this community. And I, frankly, if it wasn't Beacon, I wouldn't have taken the position. Actually, I was headed to manage a hotel in Cocoa Beach.
Wow, it's quite a change.
Yeah. Well, and I had been in education, and I said, I've done this. I'm not going to do it again. And then I accepted a position at a hotel in Cocoa Beach. And the very next day, I was messaged on LinkedIn from the assistant to the provost, and she convinced me, like, just come out and look at this. As soon as I got online, I started realizing, I was like, oh, okay, I know these students, and it looks like a second chance. Like, I never knew colleges did this kind of thing until I found out what Beacon does.
Once you work at Beacon, like I did 2 years ago, you realize how little you know about the world of learning disabilities. So in that sense, it's a blessing. And now I try to explain that to corporate America. It's like there's a lot of misconceptions. They come to me and they say, well, how much is going to cost me, those accommodation? And it's like if you have sensory sensitivity, it might be just headphones. Allow your workers to have headphones. Mm-hmm. That's not expensive. And actually, your employees will pay for them. Or like we do in our classroom is to provide extra time for some tasks. Or if you have dyslexia, and actually if you suffer from dyslexia, for instance, you will have some difficulty decoding letters, so you might be better off with pictures. Mm-hmm. So it's just allowing your employees in the staff meeting just to take pictures of, instead of delivering like just plain speeches or just, you know, black and white text, mm-hmm. Just have a PowerPoint and some images or something like that.
You mentioned at the start of our conversation, Esteban, that this is a population that is not well served, and you're obviously doing good work at Beacon College, but it sounds to me there's more that could be done, not just in the world of academia, but also in corporate America. So what needs to happen, do you think?
Well, I call it the new frontier. There is a lot of misunderstanding. Some 30 years ago, we were dealing with, the Disability Act, and we provide kind of retrofit our buildings for accessibility and all of that. But in the world of learning disabilities, there are some companies like Microsoft, SAP, Deloitte, JP Morgan, Dell Technologies, and others that are kind of hiring workers under the spectrum and some with some other learning disabilities. And they are learning how kind of to provide a nurturing environment for these workers right there. Mm-hmm. We are partnering with some of those companies like Dell Technologies. We have right now, as we speak, we have three students doing internships in Texas, in Round Rock, Texas, at Dell Technologies. This is a Fortune 500 company with 150,000 employees, and we have three of our computer information systems students right there right now. But they know how to work with our students. For instance, the first year in this partnership, I remember one of the managers called my office and said, well, Esteban, everything went well, but just so you know, we have a kind of a welcoming party for interns, and your students kind of decided to go to their rooms, mm-hmm. and it's the social things. So they know that they need mentors, for instance. So for the first few weeks, they need to have a mentor so they can go to the dining hall or to mm-hmm. one of their restaurants and have someone to eat with. So those are the type of things that you do with this population. So we have these gigantic companies that are kind of leading the way. We're partnering with them. We're learning as we go. And these best practices might be replicated, or they need to be replicated in the future throughout America.
Well, Esteban Lopez is Director of Corporate and Academic Outreach at Beacon College. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having us.
And we're also joined by Jeremy Nielsen. He's a career development instructor at Beacon College. Jeremy, thank you as well.
Thank you so much.
Still to come, Orlando's food scene has grown up in the last decade. Kendra Lott, publisher of the website and magazine Edible Orlando, takes first-time visitors and long-time residents on a tour of that food scene in her new book, Unique Eats and Eateries of Orlando. She joins us after the break. This is Intersection. I'm Matthew Petty. Orlando's food scene has grown up in the last decade. Kendra Lott, publisher of the website and magazine Edible Orlando, takes first-time visitors and long-time residents on a tour of that food scene in her new book, Unique Eats and Eateries of Orlando. Thanks for joining us. Well, Kendra Lott is the author of Unique Eats and Eateries of Orlando. Thank you so much for joining us.
No, it's a pleasure to be here.
So, you're an Orlando native.
I am.
How has the food landscape changed?
Well, it's important to note that I was gone for a big chunk of it. For about 18 years, I lived in New York and upstate New York, and I was so very pleasantly surprised when I came back in 2010. I mean, I'd long, returned. My family's all still here, and I, visited the area 2 to 3 times a year at least during that time. But you know how it is. You go to the same spots or you do family things, and you're not really exploring. Mm-hmm. And when I first considered moving back and launching Edible Orlando magazine, my family and I, to really suss it out and say, okay, is this viable here? And we're thrilled to learn that it was. And I think mainly the change that prompted my confidence in that venture were the independently owned restaurants, the more chef-driven restaurants, places that, their menu wasn't a concept. It was what they wanted to cook.
How many of those restaurants that were here
when you returned in 2010 and launched Edible Orlando, how many of those are still around?
I would say the bulk of them. I mean, if I think to, you know, the six or seven, you know, kind of go-tos for us in those early days, like the Rusty Spoon, the Ravenous Pig, Lumon Park, those are all still thriving, as you know, and a lot of their alumni have gone on to, you know, forge their own successful ventures.
Mm-hmm. Things have changed quite a lot in the last 8-9 years, right? I mean, there's been a real explosion in local food, and I think pride in what Orlando has to offer. What does it look like from your point of view?
I think that a lot of that explosion, ironically enough, started in places that locals don't go to, which is our hotels and resorts, because those chefs were, because they had, you know, clientele that was coming in and expecting to see the name of a farm on a menu, they stepped up their game and provided that for them. So that was, you know, often, you know, oftentimes the first place that someplace like a Lake Meadow Naturals farm in Ocoee mm-hmm. might sell their eggs and poultry was to one of the big hotels, not to one of the smaller ones. And it trickled down from there wonderfully.
In your book, you said an exhaustive guide to eateries in Orlando. It needed at least 100 more pages. It must have been quite an effort to cut it down to the size that it is.
Yes, it absolutely was. And I mean, to the point that I literally had a dream last week where I stumbled upon this amazing soup restaurant in Lake Mary and thought to myself, oh, no, I didn't put it in the book. And then when in my dream it turned out to be terrible, I was really relieved.
So there isn't a soup restaurant in Lake
Mary? There might well be, but not one with the mountain view that was in my dream. Mm-hmm. So, but yes, it was very challenging to narrow it. And I, you know, frankly, the way that I did that was if there might be places that I like that didn't make it in. And when I sat down to write about them, if I couldn't find something to say, then I thought, all right, well, that in itself is telling.
Now, the book includes places like Winter Gardens, Neighborhood Market, You Pick Farms, and The Pharmacy. They're not necessarily restaurants per se. So
no.
How do you go about deciding, you know, what makes the cut, what doesn't?
Right. Well, these kinds of markets that I feature, like that one, like A&M Provisions, Wild Hair, these are places. I don't like the word gourmet. I'm still not really sure what that means. It kind of is like a faux upscale feel to it. But just with a reliable source of locally grown, locally made products that aren't necessarily farmers markets. Because, mm-hmm. you know, while those a couple of those are in the book as well, Audubon Park Community Market and the Winter Garden Farmers Market, that doesn't always fit into everybody's schedule or lifestyle. And oftentimes, you know, the farmers markets here are more of a way to kind of while away your morning and stroll around and eat kettle corn than really hardcore buy groceries. Mm-hmm. And I think that those markets, you know, that I mentioned in that roundup are ones where you can very reliably do that. And people do.
Are there a lot of those markets where you can do a decent grocery shop or get
not enough
your veggie draw?
Yeah, you're really going for your specialty items. And I think that a lot of the people who patronize those, as well as some of the more strictly grower-only markets, are doing so for health reasons. You know, they know that they want to get, you know, their raw milk, their free-range eggs. And where I live in Sanford, for instance, there's not a market like that. However, I can buy free-range eggs and raw milk at the feed store, at Orstmeyer's feed store. So that's our go-to for that. And we fill in with other things from groceries. I'm not normal in my grocery shopping habits. I probably go 3 or 4 times a week because I like to.
And which grocery stores do you go to?
You know what? I'm a big Aldi fan. As many of my friends will tell you, I've converted them, and I go to all of them literally, but my rule for the others is only for things that I can't get at Aldi.
And is it just because of the stuff they have in bulk, or
no, they don't have
things?
So much bulk. Sometimes there's a fun find, and I know the layout, I know what my staples are, and that they're going to be, you know, 40 or 50 cents cheaper, you know, than they are. They have a great organic line that's less expensive than everybody's house organic line. So mm-hmm. I mean, just, you know, the basics, chicken broth, you know, certain vegetables. I mean, it's limited, but I, you know, I'm other places all the time. So
the restaurants that you feature in your book, tell me about the owners of some of these restaurants, or the people who are the driving force behind some of these unique eateries.
I think that when you walk into some place and you could see what the chef owner had in mind without even knowing the backstory behind it, I think that's, you know, that's a real testament to that owner's vision. I mean, I think the Dutch Inn Eats over in Eatonville, it's so much of its place. I mean, it's, you know, in the wonderful little downtown section of Eatonville right next door to Town Hall. And it's designed, but clearly on a personal level. There's a quote from Zora Neale Hurston on the wall. You get it immediately, even before you eat there. When I visited, because it was one of those places that kept meaning to go there, and just hadn't made it by, and I thought, I need to check this out for the book. Mm-hmm. And when I walked in, there were a table full of people that I knew already eating there, and yet another person who I just know from around town walked in. So it was such a, and none of them lived in the area, but it was a destination, and it was a testament to her vision that, okay, this works here and people will come, and they have.
Mm-hmm. And before she was in that location, or her restaurant was in that location, it was basically a stand at a gas station, right?
Yeah, I think that's sort of where they did their beta, you know, part of it. I don't mm-hmm. know if they started out with a short-term lease in mind, but I mean, gas stations are kind of the new food truck, you know, in terms of spaces often with unused kitchen areas. It's a lot, you know, a lot fewer variables than a truck, you know. Gas stations don't break down. You know, it's a lower bar of entry, you know, for a chef who's just starting out, you know, financially in terms of that than a food truck.
Are there some good gas stations to eat in the Orlando area?
I have still not checked out a Arepa Burger. I always, whenever I'm on the way to the airport, I think, oh, darn it, I forgot to make time for a Arepa Burger, because going towards the airport on the 528, you see it there, and then, you know, sort of that note to self kind of thing. But yes, like the Taco Gordo over in Longwood area, just off of Ronald Reagan. There's a Roti Stop, again, not in the book, just places that I found after it had gone to press, over in Four City area that I, you know, literally did a U-turn to find. It had been open for 3 weeks. It wasn't even on Google Maps yet. But I always try gas station food. There's a great little pupusa place over between Sanford and Lake Mary. You know, they're made by hand, you know, by the husband and wife that run it, and you can, you know, get lotto tickets and beer while you're there. It's a win-win. I got very excited on the way here because I thought I saw a sign for pupusas, but it in fact said puppies, which is a very different thing.
Yeah, that is not the same thing.
So I was thinking, where does the WMFE team eat lunch? But not at puppies.
Well, we have a Lucky's Market around the corner, which is a pretty popular spot. There's also actually a King Bao. They opened up a satellite location just in that plaza as well.
Yes, and y'all are getting a lot of the satellite locations out here now, which wasn't the case. I was just selling books at East End Market on Saturday, and there was a couple that had just moved in from New York, and we were looking around saying, we found a lot of good places. Well, where do you live? And they said, oh, there's nothing out by us. And everyone agreed, not yet.
You're listening to Intersection on 90.7 News. We're talking to Kendra Lott. She is the author of Unique Eats and Eateries of Orlando, also the editor of Edible Orlando magazine. How long did it take to get this book from idea to finished product?
I'm not going to lie, I spent a lot of time ruminating on it before actually really sitting down and writing it. I mean, the entire process was about 8 months, and I spent a lot of that time, you know, kind of culling, you know, bringing it down, like, because I just, my process started with just, okay, I'm not even going to look at anything. I'm just going to go off the top of my head, you know, and then see how many places I end up with. And between doing that and checking other, you know, best of list from, you know, critics, you know, whom I trust, and saying, because gosh, you know, wouldn't I feel silly if I overlooked this one? And, you know, after that, I think I ended up with, you know, well over 150, which was just too many, which is why I tried to do so many roundups in the book so that I could squeeze in, you know, those places with, you know, with at least a listing, if not a full story or description. And then the writing part of it, a good, you know, 3 months, I would say, the huge crunch, of course, being in the last 3 weeks. And when I finally turned it in, my husband said, I'm just so glad to see you in something other than those pajamas.
that's what you write in, pajamas?
I did this because it came down to it. I mean, I've never written more than a 2,000 word piece before. I mean, this is thousands and thousands and thousands of words, wonderfully broken down into, you know, doable chunks, but I kind of had to pace myself and sit down and say, all right, I'm going to do 5 chapters today, you know, as it, you know, as the clock really started to tick. And it was like running a marathon without having ever done a 5K. You know, I didn't know what I didn't know in terms of pacing myself. I felt, you know, prepared in terms of the knowledge. I've been, you know, in essence, researching it, you know, for the past 8 or 9 years. But to, you know, really when it comes go time, very different.
So who's the book for? Do you see this as a book that people visiting Orlando, they might have heard about the food scene here, they're going to check out some restaurants, you would like them to have this book in their suitcase before they
That is absolutely. And also, as you well know, we get so many people who are new to the area, and they're of all ages. You know, not everybody is, you know, looking on Instagram to find, you know, where they want to go. And, you know, and that's certainly a great way of doing it. But other people like to have a curated collection. I know that I do. I mean, it's a different, I always say that when I know what I want to make, I Google it. But when I'm looking for ideas about what to make, I'll read a cookbook. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, this is the same way, to kind of be leisurely about planning a trip or, you know, visiting a new area. I know that, you know, when people come to visit, we all, you know, being the tourism mecca that we are, we're all lucky to have a steady flow of house guests. Mm-hmm. And I think that based on what you're doing, your needs are going to be really relative to the time that you have. Mm-hmm. I mean, there are amazing places that are tucked into a strip mall, but is that really how you want to spend your vacation? Would you rather go someplace that is in a wonderful pedestrian-friendly area like Winter Park or Sanford or Mount Dora? You know, and I think that the book will help people make those kinds of decisions before they head out.
There was that whole kind of controversy that erupted after Andrew Zimmern made some ill-chosen comments on Twitter about the food scene in Orlando, a lot of blowback. Mm-hmm. Do you think that helped kind of put the spotlight on Orlando and maybe show some people who aren't from Orlando that there is really this grown-up food scene here and you can come and eat as well here as you can anywhere in the country?
Absolutely. And I think that it helped because of the kind of blowback that he got from that, from, you know, from people like our friend Fayez Kara, you know, was so quick in responding, and it really, you know, got everybody involved in the conversation, you know, rather than just smarting from the blow. Mm-hmm. You know, he made it, he turned it into a dialogue. And, you know, the fact that there were those follow-up visits, and, you know, I think like so many places, you have to be willing to do the legwork, you mm-hmm. know, in Central Florida. And it's not, you know, it's not in your face. You have to be willing to drive to a neighborhood you haven't been to before. And I went to many neighborhoods that I haven't been to before researching this book. I didn't even know that there was a Williamsburg neighborhood until I went and was like, oh, that's where this is. Mm-hmm. But to your point, in terms of that controversy, yeah, that I think that put us on, you know, people's radar, because of course everyone comes here, or everyone's been here. But if you don't leave the park bubble, you don't always know what kind of goodness is there. And we locals know a lot.
There's a growing vegan food scene in Orlando too, at least vegetarian.
Absolutely. And oh my gosh, I had such a fun time going to the vegan and vegetarian eateries, you know, researching that, because it had been a while. I mean, like mm-hmm. Dandelion Cafe, you know, our community cafe, for instance, I hadn't been there in years. And, you know, their new chef, Mark Thompson, is really just lightened up the menu, using all kinds of fun things. You know, you might get a local vegetable and pickle it, and you'll see it on a salad. And, you know, it's gone way beyond beans and grains in vegan and vegetarian eating. Proper and Wild, The Sanctum, all of those places are just such a treat, truly.
If there was just like one or two things, you know, if people think about what is the signature food of Orlando, or if I'm coming to Orlando, I know I'm going to eat this one thing.
Mm-hmm.
Is there that thing in your mind?
I don't know that there is that thing. And I know that there was some effort to create that thing, you know, a few years back. And a lot of people jokingly suggested turkey leg. I think just if, you know, if people really look to the smaller farmers markets and find that one thing. I mean, they're harder, like shell peas. That's something that you're not going to find outside of the area where they grow. They're too fragile. Mm-hmm. Ditto green peanuts. I mean, that's a regional specialty. I know that Florida isn't necessarily known for its peanut production to the extent that Georgia is, but in terms of volume, it really does produce. Mm-hmm. And it's one of the few areas where you can find that, what I consider to be a delicacy, legit boiled peanut.
Where is that in Central Florida?
Bags Produce in Sanford always has green peanuts in season for sale and already boiled and hot or regular by the scoop.
Kendra Lott is the author of Unique Eats and Eateries of Orlando. Thank you so much for joining us.
It was a pleasure. Thank you so much, Matthew.
Support for Intersection comes from Advent Health and from our listeners. Education reporting on 90.7 News is supported by Helios Education Foundation. Intersection's producer is Brendan Byrne. Our intern is Paola Chinchilla. Subscribe to the podcast on iTunes, Google Play, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. And we're on the NPR One app. I'm Matthew Petty. Thanks for listening.